Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. In its initial coronavirus rescue package, the federal government allocated $349 billion for small business loans. But that well went dry quickly, and some businesses were left out. Here's Leonard Egerton, one of the co-owners of Frugal Bookstore near Nubian Square in Boston, talking about it.
It's crazy. It's the way it's not going to help small businesses. I'm in Dudley area. Well, it's Nubian Square now. And there's small businesses. Mario's is one of the businesses that everyone goes to every day. He's closed. He's a small business. How is he going to come back? Those are the businesses that should benefit the most.
On Friday, President Trump signed a package with another $310 billion in small business aid, but some still worry that that aid won't go to those who need it most. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is one of those people. She represents Massachusetts' 7th District, which is home to folks like Leonard, and joins us now on the line. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Congresswoman.
I'm thrilled to be back with you. Can you hear me?
I can. Thanks for checking.
Okay, great. And also, I just want to say that I am a big supporter of Frugal. They have completely, our library has many a book that has been purchased from Frugal's in Nubian Square, and they provide such an important service to the community, and it's important that they can reopen when this is behind us.
We actually heard from Leonard that you were one of his customers, and I did want to ask you, what was your reaction to what you heard Leonard say there? He was expressing dismay not just for his own business, but for the businesses in his community.
Well, it's devastating and infuriating and unsurprising.
What do you mean by unsurprising?
Well, minority-owned businesses and those truly small businesses, like our independent bookstores and beauty salons, barbershops, restaurants, bodegas, they have historically struggled due to structural barriers and accessing capital, struggle to equitably have the same benefits to open and to thrive. And so it is not surprising that those structural inequities are only being further spotlighted and exacerbated in the midst of this pandemic, where we are living a crisis within a crisis, so it's a public health crisis and an economic crisis.
To that end, Congresswoman, you and more than 80 members of Congress are calling for racial data on these coronavirus business loans. In a letter to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, you called on the Trump administration, quote, to amend guidance on the Payment Protection Program to reaffirm lending institutions' obligation to comply with fair lending laws and to require lenders to report on the demographics of any PPP lending. How will having that data help?
Well, first and foremost, you know, every law is only as good as its enforcement, and we do have fair lending laws. And they had provided lenders with no guidance to enforce those fair lending laws, and that's been one of the things that has been very frustrating as we work to make these massive investments in PPP to be more than just a slush fund, which is what our Republican colleagues would have them to be. That once we fight to rework it and to get those funds, that the feds keep changing the guidance on the back end, creating interim rules that only serve to exclude more people. Interim rules like if you have a criminal record, you're ineligible. 1 in 3 Americans have some sort of a criminal record. Interim rules like if you suffered a loss on your taxes, you're ineligible. So we have laws for a reason. They need to be enforced, and that's why we sent the letter. And then secondarily, the transparency that we're pushing for, I do believe that which gets measured gets done. That's why I pushed early on for the collection of racial data and the disaggregation and public reporting of it when it comes to our public health response to ensure that access to testing and treatment is equitable and that the resources are being marshaled and targeted according to the highest rate of infections, which we know is what is happening in Black and Latinx communities because of unequal access to health care for decades and because of the impacts and collateral consequences of structural racism. So I'm making the same push when it comes to who the lenders are lending to so that we can hold them accountable to ensure that fair lending laws are being enforced. And since the hurt is unprecedented and everyone is feeling that hurt, the recovery should be and the relief should be equitably felt as well.
What have you or other members, other signatories on that letter heard in response to the call for racial data?
I've not, to date, heard anything. We're going to continue to push for that. I will say that in the most recent relief package that we reported or passed out of the House, in addition to that $320 billion massive investment in more PPP, we were able to get $60 billion in set-aside for our minority deposit institutions and our community development financial institutions, CDFIs and MDIs. And so that is progress, but we need dedicated funding. We have to acknowledge the historic structural barriers. We have to acknowledge how much harder this is for those communities that have historically been unbanked and underbanked. Just the fact that the PPP distribution was first come, first served, and the fact that everyone is going through the same Small Business Administration portal, nonprofits, faith-based institutions, small businesses. Of course, it is going to immediately disadvantage those who have historically been disadvantaged. So the response has not been equitable.
That brings up an interesting point, because there are those who will push back on the assertion that businesses owned by people of color are disproportionately impacted by saying this is an overall small business problem because that funnel was so tight. The money went away so quickly and the restrictions were so difficult. So how do you parse out the difference between a shared experience by the whole small business community and an experience that's specifically unique to businesses that are owned by people of color?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, again, we needed to get relief out. We needed to move with urgency. We continue to push for greater oversight and for guardrails and to monitor the implementation, lessons that we learned from previous relief packages where we saw those funds going to Shake Shack and Potbelly's and Ruth Chris Steakhouse. The response, the relief needs to be equitably felt by those micro businesses, those businesses that are truly too small to fail, and then certainly within that are minority businesses. And that's why for the next relief package, I'll continue to advocate for dedicated funds for our minority businesses and with an emphasis on grants, not loans. There's a way in which those loans can be forgivable, but by and large, that won't be the case. So pushing for more dedicated funding for minority business enterprises in the form of grants, and that's really just what's necessary, and the transparency and the enforcement of the fair lending law.
Do you think you're going to be able to succeed in getting the data that you've asked for, both on the public health side, as you mentioned, and on the economic side, to really examine how the federal government does in distributing this money to people of color who are both experiencing the virus and who are experiencing the economic impacts of that virus?
Well, we were successful. Our letter was not immediately responded to. The letter that we sent to the Health and Human Secretary, Secretary Azar, early on, banging the drum and the need for the collection of racial data and the disaggregation and public reporting of it. But I introduced legislation after their non-response, and that bill was ostensibly wholly integrated into our last relief bill. And so what that means is that now that is federally mandated across the board that the collection of racial data is happening in our public health response, and it's married with $1 billion in resources so the states will have what they need to collect that data, but also then to deploy the resources like mobile testing units, to do contact tracing, antibody testing, more funds for our community health centers. And so that was an uphill climb to, as we were making the argument for people to understand why we needed to move with urgency, that we weren't saying, let's collect data for the sake of collecting data. This was about saving lives. And so we were able to get that in. And so we just have to keep fighting when it comes to the equitable response and the economic recovery and for these dedicated funds for minority business enterprises and for the enforcement of our fair lending laws and transparency in real time, collecting that data on who these lenders are lending to. Again, just saying that it was first come, first served, put at an advantage the more valued, wealthy customers, since most banks were only working with those that they already had existing accounts with.
So I want to shift gears for a minute. I know you know here in the Commonwealth, we've plateaued at hospitalizations for almost a couple of weeks now, and that the governor has just extended this, both the stay-at-home order and the non-essential business order, stay-at-home advisory and non-essential business order, through at least the 18th of May. What are you hearing from your constituencies here in the Commonwealth as we live through this pandemic?
Well, first, I just can't underscore enough just how much I feel for the impact on our small businesses. I'm on the phone with many of them throughout the day, and they are afraid in given the unprecedented nature of this herd and the uncertainty of how much longer we will be experiencing this new normal. However, I reject these sort of binary choices. We have an administration that seeks to prioritize markets and profit over the very lives of people. And so our greatest wealth as a nation is the health of our people. And right now we have to prioritize the public health. But in the meantime, there are other things that we can do holistically to mitigate some of this hurt and to provide holistic relief. And that's things like canceling rent, canceling mortgages, moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures, canceling student debt, passing paid sick leave, paid family leave, you know, a greater investment in our community health centers. These are just some of the things that I'll be fighting for in the next relief package, along with more PPP and more dedicated and rather dedicated funds for our minority business enterprises, because that hasn't happened to date. The last package, again, did have that carve out of $60 billion for CDFIs and MDIs, but we need that is that can't supplant the need for dedicated funding for minority businesses. And again, we have to ensure that all small businesses, true small businesses that are too small to fail, that are the lifeblood of our communities, who hire locally, who keep us going, the heartbeat, you know, of our communities, that they have the resources and the support that they need. But that means not just seeing them as small business owners, but recognizing that they're a part of families and broader communities. And so some of the other things that I've talked about, I think, are also critical in the next relief package.
So, Congresswoman, in our last 30 seconds or so, briefly, a member of the Massachusetts delegation, Congressman Jim McGovern, has proposed remote floor votes during the pandemic. Is that a critical next step for Congress?
It needs to be. I think it's long past time. I wish that we would have moved on a vote when we were last in Washington. I just returned from there, again, having voted on the last relief package. We have to modernize Congress. We have to also prioritize the public health. We were prepared to return to Washington on Monday, received health care guidance and counsel advising against 400-plus members returning to Washington and going through airports and that sort of thing. And so in prioritizing the public health, we need to stay put and we need to stay at home. But we need to vote remotely so that we can get this relief out and move with the urgency and address the scale and scope of this crisis.
That's Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents Massachusetts' 7th District. Be well, and thanks for joining us today.